I'm speaking today with Charles Fraser, the president of Radiance Innovative Services. Charles also serves as the domestic violence therapy director within Radiance. His job is to deal directly with those who have been charged with domestic violence offenses. The scope of these offenses is increasing throughout the world, especially now as we face the coronavirus. Charles has an extraordinary breadth of knowledge, both in domestic violence, its therapy for its victims and its offenders, but also he has a great deal to tell us about our own relationships with ourselves and with our families. To put it in cold terms, the business of domestic violence and therapy is, would you say it's expanding right now because of the situation we're in with people being clustered together at home, almost in a way they've never been before?
Well, I mean, it's always been underreported, and it's always been a major challenge. I would say more is intensified.
Domestic violence.
Yes. I mean, there's definitely an uptick in more calls to police and to the domestic violence shelters, as well as people visiting domestic violence websites. But in general, we see the intensity increasing.
I have so many questions for you, Charles, just from that. But let's go back a little bit. You've been doing this now. You've had Radiant Innovative Services for 10 years. You started in 2010. This is your 10th anniversary. Obviously, you've seen things change and develop over the years. But of course, in the past couple of months since the onset of the pandemic, I'm sure so many things have changed. But when did you first become aware that COVID-19 was affecting your business, your clientele, the people you work with?
Typically, our business is run like most counseling centers, is face-to-face. Prior to COVID-19, we did very, very little. I would say less than 5% of virtual sessions. And they were only for exceptions. If someone was a truck driver driving across the country, couldn't get to counseling, but was mandated or felt the need to get help, we would sometimes make that exception. But as a result of COVID, we have had to be creative in how we do what we do. For example, in the past, we would run groups. Even though there is technology to run groups, we've opted to offer individual sessions, which has been quite interesting. I'm learning a lot about the process and the model. We're going to actually make some changes even after COVID is over as a result of our experiences.
What type of changes?
So for example, right now our treatment process is a combination of individual and group. And typically we run groups for about 90 minutes. 30 minutes of that time frame is spent on check-ins. What I'm realizing is that it is very, very helpful and very productive to have one-on-one conversations with these men and also the women who are in individual sessions about what's going on with them, not just what happened, what led you to treatment, but really the day-to-day struggles of how well they're integrating information. Now, we can get some of that through check-ins in a group, but what I'm finding out is that I'm learning so much more about these men. And because it is one-on-one, they are more comfortable being more transparent and sharing what's going on in their lives. So I'm thinking, wow, why couldn't we maybe do a group for an hour and maybe do 30 or 45 minutes as a virtual type of check-in session each week. So it'll give the guys a group experience, which is really, really important, but it also gives a clinician an opportunity to really develop a therapeutic alliance with the client.
So let's go back to the basics of your practice and what you do. When people think of domestic violence who haven't been too close to that world, fortunately for them, they think of someone being, the police are called and someone, a man is dragged away and put into jail. And they really don't think about what happens after that, or they think about the worst case scenarios, in which case someone is hurt or worse, and that the offender goes to jail. But of course, the vast majority of cases, that is not the case. And that's where you come in. So tell us a little bit about, I know there's not a typical case of domestic violence, but how does the process work from the time the offense may begin, through law enforcement being called, the court process, and then to you?
Sure. So basically, we've seen a major shift in our society. If you date back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, you would see a society that tolerated domestic violence. It was almost accepted for a man, a husband, to rule his house and somehow being morally responsible for his partner or wife. And that would include, if needed, according to the man's discretion, some domestic violence, some aggression. And we've seen the shifting where America had said, you know, this is unacceptable, that we need to have women and children and a family system to be a safe environment. And so we've seen laws really just shift where there's any acknowledgement of violence in the home, police are called, someone is going to be arrested. We still have a very victim-driven domestic violence response, meaning that most of the resources are allocated, dedicated to helping the victim escape, heal from the violence. And that is an important thing. Safety is number one. As you stated earlier, you know, unfortunately, there are cases where it's a matter of life and death. All right. But on the other hand, we haven't done such of a good job in really figuring out how do we support this family system so that when they do come back together, we can mitigate, reduce the chances of this violence happening again. Because we know, according to research, it will take a woman 6-8 times before she will finally leave. She may call the police, protective order. They get back together. They may get together, and then there's another incident. It'll go back and forth, this dance, until at some point she will decide that she had enough and she will finally leave the relationship. But in the meantime, think about how much potential harm and damage to the children and to herself when we don't treat the total problem. So this is where I come in. I have a very strong conviction that it's important that we not demonize these men, that these are, again, men who are making poor choices, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they should be forgotten or discarded. And so I developed a model that really provides treatment, not punishment, to these men. It allows them to regain their dignity and find healthy ways to address their own trauma, their own, you know, inability to deal with conflict.
So you mentioned earlier working with the men, of course, but then you slipped in the fact that you work also with women. And are these women offenders or are these the victims of the violence?
Typically, they are women who have been exposed to the violence. So we do have a program that we work with the women who are survivors of domestic violence. We provide individual clinical services, helping them to tell their story, heal from their trauma, get some psychoeducation about things they can do, including developing a safety plan, but also empowering them, knowing that they have a right to live in a home free of violence, that they have a right to be in a relationship that is healthy. So we do provide that service. And oftentimes, we will work with the survivor and her partner who's in domestic violence offenders treatment, and eventually down the road, then we can do some couples work to really help them learn ways to communicate with each other and to resolve conflict without it crossing the line.
And crossing the line is something we'll bring up in a little bit, because that is the title of your book. So what? How many couples, or what percentage of couples, actually end up in that couples therapy? Are they doing it to remain together, or are they doing it, I imagine both scenarios, to have some sort of healthy relationship so that their children can not be exposed to this violence?
Yeah, you're right, Ray. It's really both. I mean, some couples have made a decision mutually, or just one person decided, I don't want to do this anymore. Even though the person is no longer using violence, I'm just done with the relationship. And so with that situation, we help the couple, if they have children, work together from a co-parenting perspective. How do we work together as parents to provide the best environment for our children, you know, as we share caring for the children? And there are times when couples have decided that, you know what, we did some things wrong. The man acknowledged that he, used violence, and the woman has healed from that, and she's willing to accept him back. We work on then how do they establish healthy in their relationship, because most couples don't know what healthy look like. They have this romantic fantasy about what a relationship is about, as you know, right in the crossing the line introduction, where the thought is that, you know, I love him and I'm feeling all these feelings and it must be love. And we all know that will not last too long. Mm-hmm. So many couples, I'm learning, don't really know how to foster healthy. It's something that needs to be developed, learned, cultivated, and especially with couples who have been involved with domestic violence.
So they're starting from a difficult point. Perhaps neither party has healthy relationship skills. They've perhaps never seen them before, so they have to know that they exist and then learn them and then put them into practice, all in the midst of a global pandemic where people are stuck at home together, and perhaps one or both persons has left their job, or has no longer has a job. So I like the illustration in the beginning of your book, Crossing the Line, where a friend of yours advised you never to look backwards at a ride on Disney World, because if you look backwards, the unintended direction, you'll see how everything works. You'll see all the stairways and the exit signs and somebody's lunch and people walking around, the mechanics, and the magic is gone. And in essence, that's what apparently it happens in a relationship. We see behind the curtain after a matter of months or a year, and we might not like what we see behind that curtain. We think we've been deceived. And then the person who's been holding up the curtain, both people have been holding up a curtain, doesn't like anyone seeing behind their curtain, doesn't like seeing all the ugly stuff. And that ugly stuff is where you come in and has to be exposed completely in the light of day and then dealt with. Because I would imagine that is where some of the domestic violence comes from, that ugly stuff behind the curtain.
Yeah, it's really a thought of, what you see is what you get. However, sometimes we don't spend enough time to really see what we're getting. And sometimes what we see is so distorted because we want to see what we want to see that we, don't really understand that, like you said, that this magic that I'm feeling is not necessarily going to sustain a relationship. It's interesting. In neuroscience research, it shows that the love that I feel initially when I meet my partner, and I wouldn't even call it love, but the feeling, the emotion that I have, is really located in a different part of my brain versus the love that I have that sustains a relationship over time. All right. So it's clearly, something going on, which is a good thing. It's a trigger that, wow, something is happening. But then, as you said, the analogy of the Wizard of Oz kind of pulling that curtain back, or the roller coaster or that ride in Disney, not looking back. I mean, at some point, you're going to have to lift the hood of that car and really see what's going on. I think in America, we've lost the art of courtship and dating. You know, there was a reason why, you know, people spent time getting to know each other outside of communicating via online or texting each other, or, you know, decide to live together before they even know each other. And I think we've lost it. I think we've kind of gone from friendship straight to partnership. And I think we've lost the middle part of that, which I'm writing about now, is a thought of companionship, a thought of, you know, we just don't take enough time to be friends with our partners, and therefore we don't know them, they don't know us. And because we have not created that sense of safety and security in a relationship, I can't be vulnerable, and therefore I don't have a companionship, all right? Mm-hmm. I don't really enjoy spending time with you. I don't even know what you like. I don't even know who you are. But then we have a partnership because we are working together on mutual goals, raising kids. And it can be very, very confusing. And you could imagine already with the messages that we give men, and we like to call it the masculinity box or a masculinity trap, that we say this is what a real man is. So we take that and add the lack of interactions, communication, skill building that we now are faced with, you can see why there are a lot of couples having difficulty today.
That's an amazing point, a very powerful one, in that you're right. With this culture we have now, I mean, almost a hookup culture that leads to intimate, or supposed to be intimate relationships, that bypasses companionship, friendship, acceptance, and so that a person can end up in a relationship yet feel totally alone. Because we often hear, you know, people want to be seen. I want someone to see me, you know, and really not acknowledge my existence. And I thought, I've been thinking lately, it's like, well, many people, I don't know if that's true. They want to be looked at, but they don't necessarily want to be seen. Mm. I'm not sure, you know, not only are we reluctant to, you know, we don't like what we see when we look behind the curtain or under the hood of our partner, we certainly, many, don't want our own hood to be looked under, because we're the only ones that really know the ugliness that's under there. So I don't mind being looked at, but I really don't want to be seen that closely. And when someone gets that close to me and does and sees some of the things I don't like, especially as men, our responses, our culturally acceptable responses, we haven't got many as men. We've got anger, and that's about it. And you talk in your book about the anger funnel, and I find that truly fascinating. It makes so much sense and resonates, because it seems to me that anger, rage, is really the only, not only acceptable emotion for men, but it's often glorified in movies and everywhere else, in sports and entertainment. When men get angry, that's the emotion we're supposed to have. And other than that, crying, depression, weakness, vulnerability, that is just not something, not only that we didn't learn, that is not accepted, even by sometimes our partners.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I've developed a model called Healing to Healthy. We're calling it H2H. And really, the whole thought of the Healing to Healthy model is healthy me equates a healthy we. And basically what I've been really working with men is that the primary focus of treatment is to work on you. All right. I'm not interested in hearing about your partner and her mental health illness and her shortcomings and her limitations. Really, the work that needs to be done, and for men, this could be very uncomfortable because they don't really want to talk about themselves. We don't like the thought of having that spotlight kind of pointed in and not out. But what I'm finding is as men take the challenge and go outside their comfort zone, they're learning that there are a lot of connections between their past and their present. And very often they have unresolved past that they've brought forward to the present that's really causing a lot of problems in their relationship. So the goal is really to help these men in general, and I'm included in that, to really focus on themselves, to be healthy men, to make sure that they are able to know what they want, understand what their limitations are, know how to communicate their feelings, express themselves in a way without, you know, being hurtful or aggressive or intimidating to others.
So I mentioned the anger funnel and a little bit about cultural acceptance of men's emotions. Tell us a little bit about that, because you're the expert on that. And when you first explained it to me, it was though something I didn't even try to articulate for decades was suddenly, you opened up the box for me and it made so much sense.
Sure. So, I mean, as we stated earlier, I mean, if you look at the mass media branding, and if you ask any person, like, what is a man? We'll get the typical, you know, descriptions of provider, protector. Some people may even say hypersexual. Some people may even say aggressive. But men are really depicted, and it's really reinforced over and over again, not just by the media, but within our family systems, within communities, that this is how a man is supposed to react, all right? Basically, you hear the statements, big boys don't cry, all right? You hear the statements, you know, suck it up, deal with it. And oftentimes, I like to give the analogy of the little boy, little girl type of response, just to show how this type of emotional funnel works. If you, for example, I would use an example. Say if my wife and I are in a grocery store, we have a 2-year-old daughter, and we're walking in the grocery store, and she sees a toy. I don't know why they have toys in a grocery store, but they do, right? And she gets excited, and she starts running towards that toy, and she trips in her excitement and skins her knee. All right, typically a dad, and I have talked to many, many dads, hundreds of them, and everyone pretty much with a resounding yes would say, I would pick her up and I would look at her boo-boo, I would kiss it. I don't care who's around. I would, you know, make funny noises and say words that don't exist, right? To express to my daughter that dad really, you know, is connecting with your pain. But if we take that same family system in that grocery store, but replace the little girl with a little boy, same age, sees a toy aisle and gets excited and goes running to that toy, trips, skins his knee, all right? The response from that is going to be totally different. It really explains this whole anger funnel and about emotion, because most dads are going to be attentive. They're going to go, they're going to check to see, oh, it's a skin knee, you're okay, you're a big boy, you're a man, rub the knee and send the boy on his way. Now, you can see the difference in how emotional responses, where boys get the message early on, they're not showing any emotion outside of being aggressive and angry. So when we take any emotion that men feel, depression, sadness, jealousy, insecurity, fear, and we take it and we place it on top of that funnel, when it comes out in the bottom, oftentimes what we see is anger, because that's what we know. You know, that's our comfort zone. That's our kind of default emotion that we as men tend to lean on.
And it's what's allowed. I mean, by, you know, it's even by our partners sometimes, it's, you know, they don't want us to be angry, but that's the one emotion they understand coming from men. Is anger.
Yes, because even women have been, you know, subjected to this mass media, you know, branding, socialization. So you'll hear, I'm amazed where women will say, he's a nice guy, but he's just, you know, he's just not, you know.
He's too nice.
Yeah, he's just too nice. He's not, you know, and they're a little uncertain how to say it, because in so many words, it's like, he doesn't have that swag. He doesn't have that kind of and but he's a good guy.
Yeah.
But then we see them then turning to the so-called bad boy.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we all are subjected to, you know, this kind of masculinity branding that happens all the time.
Have you seen any pushback when you work with men and they start to get in touch with other emotions and realize it's okay to experience them and they become, say, more sensitive and empathetic and express other emotions besides anger? Have you seen pushback from their partners saying, I don't like this new version of this guy, the healthy version, because it's not the person they knew?
It's a really good point, Ray, and I do hear that from the men, not oftentimes from the women, their partners, but for the men, they'll come back to me and they'll say, Charles, I tried what you suggested. I tried, you know, assertive communication. I tried to, you know, be empathic. I tried to validate her, and she looked at me as if, you know, I was the biggest wuss ever. And so, yes, and it can be very confusing. This is why I believe both partners need to be in treatment. It's not to blame the victim. She's not at fault for her partner using violence or aggression to express his emotion, but she also has been exposed to that violence, and she needs to heal and also understand what he's experiencing, so that way the two of them can hopefully create a new relational paradigm.
That's incredible. So I just want to cover two more topics. One being what has, you know, effects has the pandemic had on people being in close quarters, and then maybe get your thoughts on some helpful hints for people listening and what they can do, not only just now and the fact that they're maybe home with the kids and sequestered away from the rest of the world, but going forward too, you know, your best bets for a relationship. But first of all, what have you seen? We've heard a little bit of news stories in the media about domestic violence on the increase because of COVID-19. But of course, there's not enough information and data for real statistics yet. So you're perhaps, I think, the best qualified person to bring us any analogy as to what's actually happening as far as instances of domestic violence and why it might be increasing.
I mean, I have looked at some of the data that's out there, specifically looking at Connecticut. I'm not sure how many people are aware that the Hartford Police Department with the mayor have established a special patrol unit to just deal exclusively with domestic violence calls and investigations. There's some research out there that says that there's been an increase of about 15 to 20% increase in calls. New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, the tri-state have been kind of working together on some level, just trying to figure out how to respond to the potential uptick of domestic violence incidents. In my practice, I've been... you know, I haven't seen like an incredibly increase in calls for domestic violence treatment. But I think a lot of that is because a lot of the agencies and the court systems and everything pretty much is on hold or really working and really at a very small scale.
I don't mean to interrupt you right there, but that's been on my mind. How are courts working right now? Not just for domestic violence, but, you know, someone gets arrested, they're held overnight or put on bail, then they show up with 200 people on Monday morning to hear their case. How is that all happening right now? Not only in Connecticut, but throughout the country.
So, I mean, my understanding is for the state of Connecticut, the court system is really operating on a limited basis. Cases that are considered, you know, essential, important, such as protective orders, restraining orders, they are still hearing those cases. But like divorce cases, family cases, child custody cases, even I have many clients who are are waiting for their domestic violence cases to be held. These are not emergencies. These are not, you know, a life or death situation. So they have to wait. And it can be frustrating. I have one client who's been on his monitoring bracelet for, you know, months, and he was supposedly kitted off right before the pandemic hit. So his case keeps on getting continued month to month. So
there's going to be such a backlog at some point. Well, there is now, but I mean, once it finally, they finally figure out how to do it, there's going to be an enormous backlog.
Yeah.
But something you said kind of concerns me. So you, so we think there seems to be an increase in domestic violence incidents, but you're not seeing any increase in, from your end of it. So does that mean not as many people are getting arrested? It's not being processed? Or is this putting more people in danger, if that's true?
Yeah, I think the whole bureaucracy in the system of referring and getting people into treatment is not necessarily working as fluidly as it was before the pandemic. So I think, you know, people may be getting arrested, and instead of being referred to programs, they may be, you know, on hold or delayed. I know one client of mine recently turned himself in and thought he would get out the same day, and he's still in jail now. The system is just working very slow, from getting bail bondsmen to getting your hearing to, it's just not a good time to be, it's never a good time to be in a criminal justice system, but this is clearly not a good time because things are definitely moving a lot slower. But remember, Ray, you know, we could take those numbers, 15-20%, and probably times them by 2 or 3, because we know that there are still a significant number of DV cases that go unreported. As a matter of fact, there are victims that they don't even know they're victims, but they don't even know that they're being exposed to domestic violence, because for some people, they view domestic violence as just a physical act. And some people don't even view the a physical act as it, only if they have some type of bruise or injury. So my partner might have smacked me, and I accept that as just part of what takes place. I'm not happy about it, and it's not good, but I may not view myself as a victim, or we are pushing each other, or we're throwing things at each other. So there are,
it's like a scale, a spectrum, really.
Yes, many more cases that would fall under the definition of domestic violence and a state statute of what domestic violence is that is not being reported.
So I'm guessing at this, but if there's a spectrum or a scale of domestic violence offenses, from maybe throwing something or yelling or emotional and or mental abuse,
yes,
to the very worst of violent and physical harm, that is there an escalation if it isn't addressed along that scale typically?
Yes, it is. And that's the danger. And this is the reason why I take the position, I don't care how you get to me, just get to treatment. Right. And so sometimes people say, well, it wasn't that bad. And you'll hear lawyers, you know, plead their client's case. Why do you have to be in treatment? And my response to them is, pay me now or pay me later. That what we typically know about domestic violence behaviors, they don't go away, for one, by itself. And number two is they tend to escalate and become progressive. So me calling your name might have worked for a month or two, but now you become numb to it, so I need to escalate that. So now I'm going to lock you out of the house. And after you find a way to get in the house from the back, that doesn't work anymore. Then I start, you know, interrogating you every time you go out of the house. So you can see the behaviors over time will become more progressive. Most offenders don't wake up one day and say, you know what? I think I'm going to stop being, you know, abusive to my partner. I think I'm going to stop, you know, hitting her or calling her names or controlling her. That just doesn't happen, because these are behaviors that are ingrained, and there are a pattern of behaviors that is reflective of some dysfunction that needs to be addressed.
And that's what makes it so diabolical. It starts from utter charm and two people fall in love and they think the relationship works. And then very slowly, it's like the frog in the kettle. That, you know, this one thing happens and it wasn't that bad. But then they get accustomed to that. Something worse happens. They get accustomed to that. And before they know it, it's to a point where they can't believe they're getting become accustomed to.
Right. They keep on moving the needle of acceptance and tolerance, right? Yeah. And what we know with domestic violence, you know, murders, oftentimes the victims underestimate the rage of their partner. Most domestic violence victims are in their home or with their partner voluntarily. It's not as if they were kidnapped and then taken and killed. Typically, it's done in the home or in a safe environment, so to speak, or a familiar environment. So I see this over and over again where women will tend to say, I got it. I know him. He'll calm down tomorrow morning. He'll be okay. Not knowing that this man internally is at a place where some serious fatal harm can be done.
Wow. So being in the home, that's where everybody's supposed to be right now. What dynamics have you seen changing in the instances of domestic violence or how they happen or what you're hearing from clients when they come and work with you?
It's interesting. I'm hearing two extremes, all right? I'm hearing on one level, wow, I'm actually reconnecting with my partner.
That's great.
This is like all the stress of going to work, dropping the kids off, you know, picking up dinner and all the other stuff that we typically do in our family systems. I'm finding some couples and I'm finding some men report to me that this has really helped rediscover what's important to them. So I'm hearing that part, which is really refreshing. I had a couple session last night. And I said to the couple, when they first came to my practice to see me, the relationship was pretty much at the end. And typically people will come to therapy hoping that you could throw, you know, a lifeline out. But they couldn't even look at each other, had nothing good to say to each other, Ray, the first 3 or 4 months of the treatment. And yesterday, through Zoom, they were not, of course, they had to sit close together because of the camera, looking at each other and was paying each other compliments. And I had to stop them for a moment. I said, whoa, you guys here, what's going on here? You guys like have actually complimented each other 6 or 7 times so far. So what's my point? My point is that there are some people, couples who are finding this time as a moment to say, let's reset.
Did that particular couple understand what was happening? Was it, did they acknowledge the fact that that was happening and maybe because they were in close quarters?
Yes, they did acknowledge. Once I pointed out to them, they both kind of had this smile like, oh, that's interesting. You know, we are being nice to each other. We are, you know, complimenting each other. But they, you could just see just by their affect, they're in a whole different place. Mm-hmm. So, For some, and I'm not suggesting it was just the coronavirus, but they were already starting to heal and do their work. But as a result of having this intense time together, they really have been able to reset on some level. And what the male in the relay said to me is like, I've realized that some of the things that I've been fretting about really isn't all that important. And I really stopped him at that moment. I said, I want you to hear what you just said. Yeah. Because oftentimes in relationships, what we really fight about, where the conflict is, I call it the category, is it really worth it? You know? And if it goes in that bucket of, is it really worth it? Then really, maybe you shouldn't, you know, fret so much when you're not talking to each other for a week. You know? Yeah. Maybe it's not worth that. But then on the other side of the spectrum, Ray, unfortunately, I'm hearing, you know, situations where it is getting very stressful, very intense. And I've been working with my clients just to help them manage. You know, they're like, I'm going crazy, Charles. I mean, we're on top of each other. Kids are home. I don't know what to do next. And so the good news is that these men are talking about what they're feeling and what they're experiencing, which is always a good sign towards really working through the issue.
It must be difficult too. I mean, you're working with the people who have, for some reason, come to you, whether it's law enforcement or on their own, and those are the people you're talking to. But there's, of course, just in our area alone, hundreds of thousands of others who aren't talking to you, aren't talking at all, and just like a powder keg, I would imagine, because they're in, within those situations, have no skills to talk or express their feelings, and no desire to do so. And it's going to be difficult to see what happens when that comes out. So I wanted to ask you, so it, not only in this time, and but for relationships, we get bombarded with so much information. But you have a unique perspective in looking at relationships, and that you see them at their absolute, quite frankly, worst, when something very bad has happened in the relationship. So you don't, it's not just a maintenance of relationship you're looking at, but sometimes a reparation. Many times, of course, it's a permanent separation. But what counsel would you give, 3, 4, 10 points would you give to people that are the most important things they should know about relationships now in the time of coronavirus and for the rest of their lives, if they want a relationship for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I really appreciate the question. So first thing I would say to anyone who's in a relationship or thinking about getting in a relationship is that relationships are complicated and complex. That's the first thing I tell, because I want to normalize the fact that you are going to find yourself at times being challenged. That there is no such thing as a perfect relationship, but you can have a healthy relationship. And that's really the target, is to get to a place where you are able to foster a healthy environment where you and your partner can thrive, you can grow, you can get closer and be the best that you can be as a result of the relationship and also who you are as individuals. Another thing I would say to anyone in a relationship or thinking about the relationship is learn how to express your feelings and emotions. And that can only take place if both individuals create a safe environment, emotional, safe environment where they can be vulnerable with each other. All right, because if I am not being vulnerable, if I'm not being honest and truthful to you, I'm not being authentic. And over time, if authenticity is not present in that relationship, it will cause some problems. So if you see couples who are really in a good place with each other, it's not because they don't have any arguments. It doesn't mean they don't have any conflict. They have figured out a way to create an environment where they can be safe and they can express. They can be, open and say, I'm feeling this, or I didn't really like when this happened. And they know their partner is going to hear them, validate them, and they're going to be able to work it through. So I would say, those are some of the things that, one may want to consider when they're talking about relationships, they're talking about healthy. And there are, the list goes on and on. I could talk about trust and what truth and transparency, and the list goes on and on and on. But what I find, couples who know how to resolve conflict in a healthy way are couples who will probably be a lot happier and healthier. All right. A lot of what I see, Ray, in my practice is that oftentimes couples do not know how to resolve conflict. So conflict is going to happen. There's no way we're going to avoid it. It is. If it's not here today, it'll be here tonight, tomorrow, next week, next month. At some point, there will be a point of contention. And for me, as a clinician, I'm not afraid of the conflict. I think conflict is an opportunity to grow. I think conflict is a way to look at things to say, well, maybe there are areas we need to work on or we need to address. So conflict itself is not the bad thing. It's really about how me and you and others really deal with the conflict. And if I become abusive, demeaning, you know, intimidating, you know, hurtful, you know, these things are going to decay the relationship versus if I'm able to look at the conflict and say, wow, I didn't look at it that way. I didn't realize you were feeling this way. This is what I'm feeling, and we're able to resolve it. You're going to have a much better relationship. Because what happens, and this is a visual I like to leave you with, is that what conflict does and what violence does is taking a beautiful sculpture, all right? And that sculpture me and you may place in the center of our room because it's just so beautiful and we love it. And every time I make a demeaning comment to my partner, every time I put her down, every time I call her names, every time I intimidate her, threaten her, I'm taking a chisel. I'm not taking a sledgehammer. I'm taking a chisel and I'm just chipping a part of that sculpture away. And what happens in relationships over time, there's so many pieces that have been chiseled away that I look at this once beautiful sculpture and I can't even recognize what it was. And oftentimes that is what happens in our relationship. It's not the big event that kills a relationship as it is those small chips, all right, of hurt, of violence, of aggression that over time deteriorates the relationship.
It's death by a thousand cuts to the relationship. That's an extraordinary analogy. And of course, if you have that sculpture in the middle of the room and both partners are sort of chipping away at each other, then it goes that much more quickly. To continue with your analogy, treat the relationship as a very precious thing and cherish it. And I think that's where your focus on keeping relationships going is focusing on how you deal with conflict. Because it's easy to deal with a bright sunny afternoon when you're both enjoying each other, but it's when those inevitable conflicts, whether they be economic or children or just an argument over seemingly nothing, dealing those openly and authentically and safely with each other seems to be the way to go about it over time.
I mean, that is what we're really moving towards. Again, this healing to healthy model really speaks to healthy me. I need to be healthy. So when that conflict does happen and I get triggered, because as a kid, someone yelled at me all the time and now my partner yells at me and it triggers me and it takes me back. And my response to my partner is not just the fact that she or he yelled at me. That response now is coupled with all of that hurt that I had as a child that I bring to the present. And so what we want to do is really work on that healthy me. Let me work on me. Let me try to be the best me I can be. So that way when I do interact with my partner, I'm giving her my best. So when I do experience conflict, I'm able to process it and manage it where I'm not causing further hurt.
I feel so many people who get triggered because of old wounds. We all have them. None of us had a perfect upbringing. Sometimes we don't even know what those wounds are. We don't even know what the triggers are, but inevitably in a relationship, things may trigger. They may open up that old wound. What's the method for getting beyond those wounds and not identifying ourselves by those wounds, not saying, well, that's my wound. I own it. It's going to be there with the rest of my life. And anybody that ever triggers it is probably going to be out of my life because I can't have that wound triggered. That's kind of a victimhood thing. I don't know what that is, but how do we move beyond those things inflicted to us at a young age that are programmed into our brain at a young age so that they're not killing relationships now?
Yeah. I mean, it's called trauma-informed work.
Yeah.
That's part of what we do.
Explain that term to me, because we hear it a lot, trauma-informed therapy, trauma-informed counseling. Could you explain that to
us? Sure. I mean, just real basic explanation is really kind of acknowledging that their trauma exists. And so as I approach the work, I'm approaching the work with the recognition that trauma is present. And so I need to not only recognize it, process it, and really find healthy alternatives to kind of move forward. Trauma is not something that me and you are trying to erase from our memory. That's not going to happen, all right? But what we want to do is find a safe place to put that trauma. So when I do get triggered, it's not the amygdala, my part of my brain, that emotional brain that gets impulsive and just, boom, respond. I want to be able to, like, oh, wow, yep, this is what's happening to me. And I'm able to give myself some space by which I can then process it and hopefully react to it in a healthy way. So trauma form is just really integrating in your practice the thought of trauma exists and developing strategies to help the client really work through that. So one of the first things you do is really, we call it excavation or exploration, taking a deep dive, really to kind of say, okay, what really has been my trauma experiences? What are my trauma triggers? What have I been, exposed to in the past? Because sometimes we kind of push those things way, way back, and they don't really surface until we get triggered. And then I have to acknowledge it, and then I have to then process it. And this sometimes is a difficult thing, all right? So it's not just good enough to say, wow, I was a victim as a child. I now need to actually start talking through it and processing it, because the more I expose it, the less power I give that trauma in my life.
That's very helpful, because otherwise we're just repeating it over and over and over again and reliving it. And every time that gets looked at or opened up, the entire wound and entire pain comes out. And there's no reason for that to happen for decades into our lives and affecting our relationships, especially if we're not even aware of it. So the discovering it is called, you call excavation, is to really dig and find out what that trauma is and where it belongs in our lives and how to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, and for some people, their trauma has been normalized. So for them, it's like, okay, yeah, my mom's boyfriend used to beat me up. So, it's like, it's almost like, yep, that happened to me. Yep, I experienced that. Yep, I observed that. And it's normalized. So even though I know it was hurtful and I know that it wasn't right, in my own mind, I may not recognize it as trauma that is potentially impacting my relationships today.
Wow, that's extraordinary. Well, Charles, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Charles Fraser, president of Radiance Innovative Services in Meriden, Waterbury, and Hartford, Connecticut, and of course now from your home. Someday I'd like to have a discussion with you about how you separate yourselves from some of the things you hear and see, and how you go about your daily normal life, if you can, having dealt with some of these issues that come into your office. It's got to be very difficult for you. What do you do to stay healthy, especially now?
I have my own self, sometimes meditation, sometimes some mindfulness. I like to exercise. I've been doing a lot more walking, running. I love golf. I love to read. I'm constantly reading and writing. And so, having fun, spending time with the family, even though we can't necessarily go anywhere. We're still finding creative ways to spend time together. So, it really is about, taking care of yourself first. first before you can take care of others. And then also too, as a clinician, you should always do your own supervision, you know, either the group supervision or another clinician, just to process and talk through things, because, you know, we're human, and we are also subjected to, you know, transference and counter-transference issues. So, but yeah, it's a day-to-day process. It's an ongoing process. But thank you for asking, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about healthy relationships. I'm really passionate about, especially with men, because they oftentimes don't seek help, but try to help this population hopefully realize and experience the total fulfillment of what life has to offer.
Thank you so much.